This week on Startup Security Weekly, co-founder and chief ops officer at Efflux Systems, Adam Bixler, joins us for our interview segment. In our security startup news for the week, the three most abstract tips to help your startup succeed, the five best presentation apps even for your startup needs. I want to talk about some non-expensive ways to make your small business feel big. And I've got some funding updates from some security companies and a giffy little company that provides us humor. Got some funding as well. So we'll talk about all that and more on this week's show. This is a Security Weekly production. Welcome, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. This is episode 15 for November 4th, 2016. I'm your host, Paul Asadorian, founder and CEO of Security Weekly and the CEO of Offensive Countermeasures, broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island. And on the lines via Skype, the beach bum himself and security catalyst, Mr. Michael Santarcangelo. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, man. Hey, everybody. Still wearing shorts.
It's awesome. Good for you.
I'm very excited about that.
I'm actually wearing pants. So just in case everyone's wondering what's underneath the desk here, I'm wearing pants. Not that I think really anyone was wondering. I don't know why I said that. But anyway, welcome to the show.
How do we open that up? That's great. Very good.
I don't know where that came from. But let's jump right into it, Michael. We got our guest on the line. Let's not keep our live audience or Mr. Adam Bixler waiting, who is the co-founder and chief ops officer at Efflux Systems. Did I say that correctly, Efflux?
You did. Okay. That's the actual pronunciation.
Awesome. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hey, thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.
It's interesting, and this is on the top of my brain as Michael was talking, and I wanted to save it for the show because we were talking about how you became the chief ops officer and how you assign roles at the startup. And it's kind of interesting with John and myself. You would think that John and I would come to the table and be like, I want to be CEO and I want to be CTO. It was a complete opposite. I'm like, dude, you're CTO. He's like, dude, you're CEO. I'm like, good, let's go. Okay, you got back to work. That was pretty much the entire conversation. We assigned each other roles and we were off to the races. So how did that kind of play out for you in this business that you have in your previous startup as well?
Sure. So I realized that a lot of my previous work experience, I'd stepped away from coding. I became more of an operational planner type. So I knew I was not CTO material. Really where I've gravitated most in startup world is designing products, designing workflows, designing ways to make things easier for people to use. But in the early days of Efflux, it was a two-person team, and somebody had to step up and do the fundraising, do the investor relations, do the sales and marketing. So that's how we consolidated those roles underneath the CEO.
Awesome. Michael, did you have a conversation with yourself about your role in your own one-person organization?
I did. It was great. It was, I walk around and talk to myself. It just kind of proves I'm crazy, so it's good.
Did it get tense at moments? Was it tense?
Well, here's the thing that's interesting about it is I'm not the CEO of the company. Mm. I've learned to say, oh, I'm the founder of it, but I've always held myself out as the president of it. And at some point when we grow, there was a point where we had employees, and there may come a point again where we do that. And I don't have any interest in being the CEO or the COO. I'll be a driving force behind it, but kind of like Adam, there's pieces to this that I'm going to be better at, and that may not be those pieces.
Sorry, my dog's in the studio. I apologize. Anyway, Michael, I'll let you have known Adam for a while, so I'll let you continue
Adam and
on
I
with,
go
with questions.
Way back. We're not going to talk about that too much, but here's the thing too. It's great about Adam on the show here is that, I mean, this is your second go around. So I'm kind of curious about a couple of things. I mean, I'd like to hear more about what you do, and you can go either way you want with this to start. You can tell us about the first one and how that led to the second one, or like I'm always curious, like what's the problem that you solve with Efflux, and how did you guys come up with it? Like, what started it?
Sure. So actually, let's back up and walk to how we got to Efflux today. My last company, Morta Security, had gotten together with a friend. We both had aspirations to do a security startup. Previously, I've done a lot of consulting work, both government and private sector. Had actually built a software development team for a commercial consultancy. Realized that they had us focused on doing some services support work to justify building software, and that was not the right way to do it. So it always wanted to just jump out and do a straight-up software-based company. Morta, we essentially, the formula is pretty easy. Got together a bunch of friends that had a good idea. We put it together into a patent. We put together an MVP. We took it out and got some customer feedback, and then went out fundraising. We realized that the team that we needed to build to scale that up required some larger investment than what we were willing to contribute ourselves. We were very successful. We took a round from three VCs out on the West Coast, but being a Maryland-based team, they wanted the team to move to the West Coast. At the time, I wasn't able to do that. I had some extended military reserve commitments that didn't allow me to. So that's when I stepped away, but started working on the concept for Efflux. What I found in my initial work with Morta was that there's a lot of great detection technology in the market, but there's not a good way to help analysts understand what happens post-exploitation. To be able to stitch together an attacker's movements inside the network is a very manual and laborious process. So what we set out to do was collect the right data to answer the right questions at the right time and enable security operations personnel to be able to identify not just an attacker getting in, but what an attacker does after they're inside the network.
I like that. So that was born basically on the back of Morta, or was that a function of trying to solve another problem that you guys were bumping your heads into on a somewhat regular basis?
It was a problem set very different from what we were doing with Morta, but it was consistent feedback that we were receiving from mostly SOC analysts, like a tier two, tier three type. And look, this was born out of our own experiences as analysts ourselves. We used to have to collect data for, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, draw the picture on the whiteboard to explain to the manager why we had to take certain systems offline, why certain remediation actions need to be taken. That 1 to 2 weeks is just giving the attacker more time to be able to spread throughout the network. So your problem becomes infinitely harder if you can never get in front of what the attacker is doing. So we set out to be able to consolidate that data, answer specific analytic questions, and enable an analyst to do something about it faster.
I like it. All right. So let's go back and build on the Morta experience. And I want to push on, you talked about the patent. What's it like getting a patent? And let's do it differently. What did you think it would be like, and what was it actually like?
Sure. So I think that just to cover the patent process, the way that we did it at Morta and the way that we've done it here at Efflux, we did a provisional patent, which essentially lets you write anything that you want. Nobody's going to check it. Nobody cares. You have 1 year to be able to convert that into a full utility patent. That was our way of saying that we've researched the market and we've researched the technology that's currently available, and we've found a very unique positioning. That was a very bold statement to make, specifically to investors, that they're not just making an investment in some guys that are going to spin off into a services company. We have a true product plan that we're following. The nice part about building a provisional patent is that you have 1 year to improve upon it, but any claim that you make in the initial filing is protected until you move on to the full utility filing. So same thing we did with Efflux. We started off with a provisional filing, which was basically our specs for our minimum viable product. We went out, validated the MVP with a few large institutions before actually building something that we could deploy in private beta. And now we've recently filed our full utility patent with the help of our lawyers.
So, Adam, is the provisional patent, is that when you can say patent pending?
Yes, you can stretch it to say patent pending. You are protected, but if you do not file your utility patent off of that provisional filing within 365 days, you lose all claims and rights to what you documented.
And is there like a rough cost that you can put around that, or is it so different for every situation that there's no real way to estimate a cost?
It depends, right? It depends on your lawyers, how much work you do yourself. I mean, you can file it all by yourself with USPTO. We opted to have our lawyers involved specifically because a patent is only as good as how well you defend it. To be able to say that you're unique is very hard to prove, and having the legal counsel behind you to validate that is extremely important.
Yeah, no.
Did you file in the U.S. or did you file other places too?
We filed domestically. We looked at doing a larger international filing, but the cost benefit just wasn't there because we're specifically trying to penetrate the U.S. market first. We didn't see the need to do that.
No, that makes sense. And that's the thing to point out too, Paul, is that every country you want to operate in, some have some agreements, but patents done right is a game of chess, not checkers. And it's there's quite a bit to it. But that's just, I mean, thanks for that insight, Adam, because that's an area that I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about. And you guys have done that quite well. All right, I want to ask too, and this board, how did you come up with the name? I mean, I love it. I had to go look it up, and it seems like it fits really well. Where did that come from?
Thinking about it way too long and hard, trying to be clever, and realizing that we had picked a name that's a little hard to pronounce was probably not the right thing to do. So efflux in microbiology is the way that antibiotics remove infections from cells. And because we were an operational company, we took a whole microbiology theme in our original product lines. We've since gotten away from that and become a little more generic in our branding. But the idea that we're removing infections as quickly as possible was the theme that we were going for originally.
See, now I thought it had something to do with a flux capacitor.
It's just like that. No, it's just like that.
It's just like that.
You get to go back to the future and solve the problems you wish that you had before. All right. So you're operationally focused. I like that. But you're still a product. So tell me what that's like trying to get people to understand this, because you're solving a problem I think most people have. So when you explain it to them, are they like, yes, come in, let's do this? Or talk to us about what it's like getting people to understand that you can actually help them solve the problem that they have.
Sure. So in designing what we do, we built out a series of user personas. Our target user is a tier two analyst in a security ops center. We find that we get the greatest advocacy with the security architect, which is typically the most senior technical person in any enterprise security organization. They're the ones that are looking specifically at the security ops tech stack. They're looking at the people and the processes that make security happen. What we're able to show value in is expediting the investigation and remediation capabilities.
Adam, you seem like you guys are very organized for a startup. And so you've already developed personas and things like that. How many people are working for the startup today for efflux?
Sure. We're up to 8 people now. What we've found is that over 80% of our organization is engineering. We early on made a conscious effort to bring user-centered design into everything that we do. We find that to be one of the large gaps in security today, is that there's great technical capabilities out there, but being able to translate that back to users, especially as we bring new analysts into the workforce, as security has hit a boom phase, being able to translate the value of these products back into something that analysts can actually use was something that we set out to do very early on with our product.
So let's talk a little bit about the organization, because I know being an 8-person startup, right, you've got a lot of things that you could be doing in terms of developing marketing plans and product management. How did you choose which ones to work on, and in which areas did you focus on, and why?
really at this stage, the focus is all about customers and solving a specific problem for them. Being in pre-release in private beta allows us to work very closely with just a handful of customers to ensure that we're meeting their needs and that we're teasing out additional functionality that we can put against our roadmap for later inclusion. Yeah, there's plenty of things that we could be doing. We're very focused on identifying our ideal customers and solving their very specific pain points. As we roll out into our general availability here in the next month, we put a bit more emphasis over the past 60 days on actually doing the, you know, the sales, the marketing, the positioning, all of the public facing stuff that you have to do when you're no longer in stealth mode.
Adam, so do you? How do you know which customer features and requests are worth building into your product and which ones aren't? Or in the beginning, are you pretty much building in 99% of what your customers are telling you?
What we like to do is inventory all possible features and then prioritize based on the amount of people that are requesting it. There's some great product management, and that's one of the things we've noticed too. Being an East Coast startup, we have great access to engineering talent, but where the East Coast lacks is really product management, sales, and marketing. This is why people look to the West Coast, because they know that a company based there can hire the talent necessary to, you know, prioritize product features and push it out into sales mode. And I think that's why a lot of the money moves a lot faster there on the West Coast. What we've focused on very heavily is product management, to be able to know that we're building the right thing that somebody's going to pay for, to then be able to backstop that with the full sales and marketing plan.
So do you have a full-time product manager, or does that fall into one of the founders' roles?
So I think, yeah, you guys are asking about what Chief Ops Officer means. It's we used it more as a catch-all for combining customer success with product management, because there is a lot of overlap there. I do a lot of my time with customer outreach, identifying what's working for them with our product and what they would like to see included next.
What are some of the specific challenges to being a security startup, Adam?
Well, we're very cautious with our technology that, you know, we're not going to take something in half-baked. Really, within security, you get one chance with a SOC, especially on the ops side. You can't come in with technology that's not at least functional, because you're typically not going to get another look. The security landscape is so crowded right now that, you know, there's 20, 30, 50 different vendors that are banging down the SOC manager's door. To be able to get looked at is your one chance typically. Unless you have some other type of momentum behind you, something else carrying you in. So our focus has really been on ensuring that once we take tech somewhere, once we say that we have a feature, once we say we're going to be able to do something, that we can actually execute on that.
Are you guys on-premise or are you in the cloud, some hybrid between the two? And what was that decision process like?
You know, it's funny, when we started, we did a lot of customer survey to determine should we be cloud or on-prem. We straddled the fence for quite some time because our initial requirement set mostly came from the financial sector. We were told that they would never put anything into the cloud. We then started getting momentum with some other more technology-focused organizations that were cloud-first and had asked that we primarily have our offering in the cloud for what they need. We've since gone into a full cloud mindset. From our deployment model, we do a software-based sensor that hangs off of any network device, span, tap, mirrored port, whatever it may be. We're crunching the content back down into Flow, so there's no privacy concerns, which allows us to push that metadata back up to the cloud for further analysis. And then we also believe in the security as an ecosystem and all the products playing nicely together. We have a fully open API, so you can either consume our data through our UI, or if you have another platform that you enjoy, then we can just push the JSON down into whatever that platform may be.
I love that. And one of the things I love about cloud, so then do you have the ability to learn on aggregate. So as you're learning what's happening with one customer, does that end up benefiting other customers, or is everybody walled off? You're using the cloud for the elasticity of the space and the processing and everything else.
We've engineered ways to be able to, anonymously extract threat data from different customer instances and be able to share that across all of our customers. So there's definitely value in being in the cloud. I would caution that there are right ways to do it and not right ways to do it. We've seen both styles executed, but being a security company ourselves, we're extremely cautious about anonymizing all customer data should we try to glean any type of insights off of it.
So you're a cloud-hosted solution, Adam. So you're incurring, Efflux is incurring all of the charges in the cloud and then basically marking up that back to the customer. Is that correct?
Exactly. Exactly. And then we use a series of different providers on the back end. We find that different cloud providers do different things well. So we're able to spread that, to optimize the right processes at the right place. I think one of the other things that we put into the engineering side is, you know, we're a full microservices architecture, so we can spin up different services in different places as needed to be as efficient as possible for our customers.
So do you span outside of Amazon's cloud?
We do.
So is it Rackspace or Azure?
You know, what's really nice is being a seed stage startup, we have access to a lot of the different startup programs. Mm-hmm. So we're continually evaluating all of the different platforms to see which ones meet our needs for the specific workloads we're trying to offload.
And I'm sure that helps control costs, because how do you control your costs in the cloud?
We looked at the cost benefit analysis of having to deploy hardware. Some of the other startups we work with, they'll incur a straight up $17,000 no guaranteed pilot to go run on site somewhere for 30 days. So they're shipping the server, they're shipping the equipment, they're putting somebody on site to do the installation. They are negotiating back with the enterprise for power, space, and cooling. Mm-hmm. Just to get in the door, it doesn't make sense. What we're focused on is analytics. We're a software company and we do analytics. So it doesn't matter to us where we run. We've just found that cloud is extremely more efficient for what we do.
Do you find it's challenging with having a cloud-only model? Does that limit your potential customer base? And do you do anything to kind of convert those people that are like, no, we have to have it on-premise and try and convert them in the cloud? Or do you just skip over them and just specifically target those who are all in with cloud?
For our stage, we focus on cloud only. Now, obviously, if there's a large enough customer that requires something on-prem, we can do that. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that we want to spend the DevOps cycles on to do unless it was a very large paying customer at this stage.
Yeah, and I think that's a sound approach. Michael,
well,
more questions for Adam?
Yeah, I do. So, well, I'm just kind of curious because you were able to take Morta to a Series A round. And I think there's some stuff in there that's probably worth exploring. But what I'm curious about is how much of that process with the first company and the success of that have you folded into this? Like, does this time around feel better? Are you more confident with it? Have you applied some of those lessons learned? Or are you finding second time around, nope, it's a totally different experience?
It's every time is different. What I've found is that second time's a little bit easier just because you build the connections off the first one and you've built enough credibility to get noticed, mostly by the investment community. The relationships are what make this so important. So being able to work with other companies that we've worked with in the past has definitely made it a little bit easier. Now I'll say some of the challenges. In doing this latest startup, we set out to do a couple things a little bit differently. Obviously, after I left Morta, they were acquired by Palo Alto Networks and stayed in stealth mode the entire time. With Efflux, we've decided that we're building this out into a business. we're intent on building a strong customer list and solving specific problems beyond just the piloting customers we're working with today. So bringing in the sales, the marketing, the, you know, all the things that make a business has been a great experience to go through this time around.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool stuff. So somebody sitting right now listening saying, I got an idea. What would you tell them? When somebody comes to you and says, all right, Adam, this, you've been through two startups. What should I do? What would you tell them?
If you don't have customer validation, I would caution anyone to not start. The we joke, we're here in the what they're now calling the cyber corridor. The Washington, D.C., Baltimore corridor. There are a lot of security-based startups that are happening here. Most of them are very technical founders, typically with a services background, that have a great idea, and they really truly do come out with some great ideas, having worked with government customers in the past. But they don't have the connection back to commercial security needs. So in trying to pivot from doing government type work into filling a commercial need without that validation that the idea that you have is something that somebody will eventually pay for, I just see it as a really long uphill battle.
Awesome. Michael, is there more questions you have for Adam, or I know we're getting close to a midway point here.
No, this is good. I mean, we've covered patents. We've covered stealth versus not stealth. We've covered cloud. I mean, this is anybody listening at home right now trying to figure it out is good. And then I think anybody who's sitting in a sock right now, they might not be watching this live, but when they pick it up, they now know that there's somebody that can help them. I think it's good.
Awesome. Well, Adam, thank you so much for appearing on Startup Security Weekly. Best of luck in your startup.
Hey, thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. Thanks, Mike.
Welcome back, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. This is the startup news and discussion for today. Michael Santarcangelo is, of course, with us. Welcome back, Michael.
It's always good to be here, especially when we're going to talk about the stories in the news and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, we got some pretty cool stuff to talk about, I will say. I really like it.
Yeah, and you know, let me chime in here real quick. I just want to say I'm loving some of the feedback that we're getting too. So those of you that keep it coming, and I know some of you have asked for us to touch on some different topics. We will. With our guests and stuff, we're going to explore the things that you guys want around founders and hiring and everything else. And that's going to influence some of the stories that we pull. So if you've got ideas or you got a story you want our opinion on, shoot it to us and we'll tackle it.
Absolutely. I got two topics that I want to start off with. The first one is the funding stuff that we just talked about during the break. And then the second one is we have a couple stories that kind of overlap and tie into like an update on my journey. So I think, that'll be good. But so I was looking at, of course, the great website Owler.com gives funding information as funding. Most funding is public. Well, there are actually very specific factors that determine whether a funding run is public or not. Right, Michael? So I looked at some, actually three different security companies and their recent funding rounds. The first one is CounterTAC. CounterTAC is develops and delivers real-time endpoint threat detection and response technology in the enterprise. They're in a very crowded market with Cylance, CyberReason, and lots of other, probably 40 different companies at least in their space. Now, their funding history, I thought was kind of interesting. So they did some debt first, $5.7 million. They did a Series A for $9.5 million. They did some more equity. They did a Series B for $20 million, a Series C for $17.9 million. They did another 10 in equity, and just recently on Halloween, which I thought was kind of interesting, they did an unattributed round for $10 million, and basically they're a total of $78 million in funding. Kind of an interesting journey in their funding, and what looks like getting enough capital to have the research and development to be competitive in their space. So it's interesting how the different areas in security, I think we're going to see different kinds of funding to be able to compete, and this is a very crowded space. Now, this company was founded in 2007, so they're not an early startup. They're pretty well established. So I have not looked in depth into their products. Maybe that's something for Enterprise Security Weekly, which we can cover.
Yeah, that'd be a fun crossover show. You know, what I think is interesting about this too is the way I start looking at it is who the investors are and how many rounds they've participated in. And in this case, their investors have pretty much stayed with them the whole time, and they've done a couple equity rounds in addition to their funding rounds. That's an interesting thing. And so their estimated revenue is $8 million. Obviously, I have no visibility into that.
Yeah, those are crowdsourced numbers, by the way.
Yeah, but yeah. Gosh, that's a lot of there's a lot of funding there. So that's interesting. I'll be curious to see how that works out.
Now it's interesting. There's another one called Simplified. Simplified develops and offers software as a service that enables the use of biometric access across any device. Now, this is a very early startup. They on Halloween, coincidentally enough, they took a $1 million seed round. So obviously that's very different from the other companies, and they had a good enough pitch and idea to get $1 million in their seed round, which is good for them. And curious to see how their company develops in that space.
Yeah, I mean that's a good seed round, right?
Mm,
I mean,
yeah, it is. You
know, that's not a Series A round where we're going to see something in the 3 to 5 million range on average. That's $1 million. So I mean that'd be a fun story to talk about to say how did you do that?
Right? Like, how did you? Yeah, with seemingly no I mean, it doesn't look like they're even in any kind of a beta or anything like that. They could be in a private beta mode, but it does not look like they have a product. Although I could be wrong. Could be something that you just sign up for.
You know what else is interesting?
Oh, yeah, sign up for our early... It says sign up for our early preview. So, yeah, they're...
Well, yeah, and you know what else I'm noticing on it? It's they're in Madison, Wisconsin. So yeah. They're not... Right, because one of the things we keep talking about is you don't have to be in this one of these cyber corridors. You can be in different places now. So that'll be interesting. If anybody's looked at this or knows it... That let us know if you think that'd be a fun interview. There might be something here to talk about.
There's the last one in security is Acalvio, which is in a very crowded space. They do advanced threat defense solutions to detect, engage, and respond to malicious activity inside the perimeter, similar to what Efflux does, actually. They're in the same market as Light Cyber, TrapX, and Ativo Networks. Sort of. Even the competition and Owler are somewhat crowdsourced, but they do a pretty good job of keeping it updated. In any case, my good friend Chris Roberts works for Acalvio, and they just took they have a Series B listed here for $17 million, which is a pretty good hefty Series B for a company in this market. And on November 3rd they took an undisclosed equity round, which is kind of interesting.
Well, you know what's also interesting in this is all it's listing is their Series B round. Mm-hmm. And their equity round. There's the seed's not listed, the A's not listed. That's interesting.
Mm. Now let's look at a technology company that's not in security, like Giphy, that we use all the time if I actually start up the Slack channel, because I've been forgetting to start up the Slack channel. I love Giphy. Giphy provides us like much entertainment. I struggled to figure out how their estimated revenue is $1.3 million. I don't know how they make money.
I was gonna say you know what's funny? I looked at the same thing and I went, they're making $1 million? How?
And it says Giphy operates a search engine that allows users to share, discover animated graphics, interchange formats on the internet. And they do have competition listed there. I'm not sure if that's actually real competition or not. But their Series A was 2.5. Their Series B was 17. They took a Series C of 55. And now on October 30th took a Series D round of $72 million for a company that Michael and I are like, how do they make money?
Yeah, and that's the thing. So I'm not sure how they make money. They might make some money, but they've taken $150 million in
funding. Yeah, and they're based out of New York. It's kind of interesting. So
what I also think is interesting is their estimated employees, right? So again, it's crowdsourced and estimated. Yeah. 27 employees.
That's a lot of money for a business that basically gives us entertainment value.
Well, keep in mind too that their Series C was only in February, so 8 months later they took a Series D, mm-hmm. and it was 50% bigger. That's That's interesting. But, you know, I think what you're pointing out there, though, is that we, is from an investment perspective, I've been having conversations outside of the program on what it's like to invest in security today. And it's interesting to hear the investors say it's hard. It's interesting to hear the startups say it's hard to get invested. It's, I mean, like the whole, everybody's feeling like, well, there's just a lot of friction around it. And I still think that's because when you say the word security or when you say cyber, right? I mean, my friend Peter Hess used to say, if you say cyber, they hear spiders and they want to stomp on it or kill it with fire. I mean, he got that right. And so, you know, I think what Giphy is showing us, and I, man, I love doing this. I hope we do this more often. You've got something that's easy to understand. It's integrated in everything. Everybody wants to be part of it. It makes us laugh on Facebook and in Slack and on our own. And that's great. Let's do that. So, yeah, they can get funded because they're going to be able to show reach. So this is probably going to be one of those, are you making any money today? No, but look at our reach. Look at our integration. Right. Now, if we just do X and can do ad revenue, right, there's going to be something that they're going to show based on their reach, their use, their adoption. If only 2% do X, boom, look, we'll make our money back.
Right.
Where in a security space, you've got to show, I mean, what we're looking at a lot of crowded spaces in security, and so now you've got to defend yourself and explain yourself better. And that's actually one of the stories that we'll talk about, but yeah.
So then you had something in there about the top five best presentation apps your startup needs. And
it's funny. That's exactly the one I was going to go to. Here's the thing. I put this one up to say, don't buy the hype. Please stop. And let me be clear. It's suggesting that you use Haiku Deck, Keynote, PowerPoint, Prezi, and Microsoft Sway. The only one I wasn't familiar with was with Microsoft Sway. Here's what I can tell you every time. When I'm in presentations, whether they're pitches or they're whatever, please just be simple and focus on your value. Like if you've got to choose between, hey, we could do this really cool animated rotational circle. Listen, focus on your value, communicate your value. The thing I've been studying for the last week or two, talking to startups and companies, number one challenge, Paul, we don't have alignment of value internally. If you don't know your value prop and you're not aligned on it internally, you will not execute against it properly externally. So please, I actually put this one up to say, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of you have talked about us talking about pitches. Obviously, I've got some time in saddle here. Don't. I like Keynote. I use PowerPoint. My suggestion is simple, clean, consistent, tell the right story. Those are the things we're going to keep talking about. But please don't get hooked up in, oh, I'll use this other thing. It's really cool. People will like it. No, I have never seen the diamond wipe shade flippy thing close a deal.
Yep. I completely agree. I think if you can't tell your story in slides without the help of advanced presentation technology, you probably don't have that compelling of a story, or you just don't have a lot as much experience in building presentations as some of us. Like I've spent way too much time building presentations, but because we've done training and stuff. But so it's interesting, Michael, as you stated all of that. One of the realizations that I came to was I'm going to use Google Slides, and it is probably the like least feature rich out of the bunch.
Yep.
However, from a tactical and communications perspective, I can get at my presentations from anywhere, right?
Yep.
If I've got a Windows laptop, a Linux laptop, or a Mac, I can go edit my slides. If I've got this brilliant stroke of genius and I go grab my laptop and it happens to be my Linux laptop, I can still edit my slides, which is big for me. It's really easy to share, right? You can share it amongst your group and collaborate on presentations easily. For me, those two things were more important than being able to have fancy fonts or animations or embedded videos. And I've actually tried some of that stuff and some of the other pitches, and it just doesn't work out. It doesn't make them portable. And I've really just converted everything, sales, pitches, everything. Even my own slides for presentations at cons now, I'm going to use slides. Now, if you're presenting without an internet connection, you have to export it in some format, which
you can't save for that. You can't save it locally.
Yeah, you can. You can export to PDF or PowerPoint, and there's a couple other options in there, but essentially PDF or PowerPoint, and still give the presentation locally without internet access. So,
yeah, no. So, and I think it's a good idea. You know, what's funny? I looked at that. One of the things that I found that I really like is I love simplicity. I embrace I'm very simple. I use like two or three colors. I denote things by color shift. I denote stuff with iconography. If you're not a member of it, thenounproject.com. $10 a month, premium level membership. You should definitely show them some love. They have a remarkable number of icons. And then you can download them as a vector file, and then you mm-hmm. can change the sizes, scale them, change colors, whatever else.
Nice.
It keeps it simple. So, you know, it's funny. I've been looking at that too. I find myself racked between, goodness gracious, I'm still on Apple. We'll see with their latest tech, how long that stays, but still using Mac. I still like Keynote. That's my default.
I do
but
too.
For everything else, I've gone to the Google. But then we're still Amazon. And so I'm looking at this going, why can't everybody play nice in the sandbox? That should be the startup. Let's go fund one of those startups. But let's go back to it then. So if you're a security startup today, focus on your value. Focus on simplifying your message. Don't be fancy. Focus on your value. It's a crowded market. So when you sound like everybody else, okay,
right.
I'll
yeah.
get around to it. I'll figure it out. You got to put some time into it. You got to pick a problem, and you've got to be really clear on how you solve it. I mean, just run through the rest of the five questions, right? What's the problem you solve?
Yeah.
How does somebody know if they're ready? What's the value that you bring? How would somebody measure it and prove it? And then remember, it's structure of communication. How does your solution integrate into what they're currently doing? How does it work? Right? I mean, Adam just talked about the fact that they've got an API and they can connect with whatever your popular tools are. Yep, there you go.
And it's interesting, you know, tactically, my sales presentation for Security Weekly, which, I mean, I'm noticing that there are a lot of common elements between a pitch deck and a sales deck. They are very different, mm-hmm. but there's common elements. And I converted it from Keynote and put it up in Google Slides. And yeah, I lost some of the more texture, feature rich kind of graphics and stuff. But I just presented it yesterday to someone who was a potential buyer and someone who was like an advisor to me as well, works for a startup and has done pitches. And he was like, dude, you nailed it. He's like, I couldn't, you know, give you much direction in either way. He's like, I think what you have is great. So
that's awesome.
You know, to hear that feedback was like, yes, okay, now I've got it. And yep. and it's in slides now. So I think that's good advice to people that have startups. Don't get too fancy and focus on your value. And keep
iterating it. Look, I mean, like, you know, we've talked about this with me, but when I started with Straight Talk, I got focused on features. And then I started focusing on benefits. And I was like, well, you can bring people together. You can give them the voice. You're going to learn. You're going to make better decisions. Coincidentally, that's still there. But what I'm finding people have gravitated to, and I'm getting smarter at listening, is it's two threads on an individual basis. And for your team, it's all about, can I get clarity of focus? Can I prioritize my action? And can I have confidence in executing, taking those steps? Which is, I mean, let's be fair. That's essential. That's essential in leadership. It's essential in your business and your whatever. But broader than, it's all about breaking down barriers and building the connections you need to get results. Okay, so I'm still playing with those two, but it's interesting how, like, if you go look at my deck or your deck from a year ago to what we got today,
exactly,
totally different, and that's good. Let me. This is the other story that I liked. It's really short. Three abstract tips to basically help you be successful. Here they are. Ready? Show, don't tell. External validation beats your opinion. The more data, the more better. I love it.
It's awesome.
Like, I just put that in to go. Yeah. I mean, and this is stuff we keep talking about, right? But like, show me. That's actually the stage I'm at with my business right now. Is I'm working with teams that say, okay, I get it, and we're going to put them through the paces for the next 8 to 10 weeks, and then I'll have the stories to tell, and I can show people exactly how it works. You'll also be proud, Paul. I'm using your idea on how it works. I'm actually going to start giving people some scenarios. How, you know? So I have X challenge. How would this work? Because mine's a little less. Yeah. Like, it only works one way. It works different ways.
I found it makes an impact too. Speaking of like abstract things and like little things that help, kind of going back to like your pitch deck or your sales presentation, you can say like, we have these customers or we're doing this thing. But when you put up a slide with like all your customers' logos, it just really seems to connect much better than just saying, right? So having some visual proof, kind of speaking to like show it, I think that it really helps in your sales deck.
No, it's really interesting you say that, because I find when people pitch me and they have, I call it the brag board.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, Skip, I don't, you know what? Tell me what you do first. I don't care who you're working with.
Oh no, mine's at the end. Well, it's at the end, right?
Okay. So
you get to the end. I've already shown them the value, right? And then you get to the end, and they're like here are the people taking advantage of the value. You've already hooked them in before I show them. And that was on purpose. That was just kind of me thinking out loud, going, that should be at the end. So I'm glad to hear that feedback, Mike. That means I put it in the right spot, which I don't always do.
Yeah, at the end, I have a lot of problem with it, because then, too, now that you've explained it to me, I might say, really? So-and-so's using it? Now I get it. We're in security. But I might say, okay, well, I know somebody there. Who can you connect me to? Like, mm-hmm. It's a much better point. But I see everybody, they try to load it up front, and I'm like, right, tell me what you do first. Make me want to care, and then we'll talk about it.
The other thing, too, that kind of ties into our discussion today, Michael, is I've been playing around with technology, you know, slides being one, but other technologies to allow your startup to feel like a larger company than it really is. And I think some people read into that and are like, well, you're masking, you know, what kind of company you are. You're trying to, be stealthy and shady about it. And I don't think that's the case. I think if you look at that as you want to behave more efficiently, and take your time very seriously. Like my comment to Adam, you know, I think it was during break, was you're probably doing the job of 8 people. To do that in a startup environment and get that accelerated growth, you have to give the appearance of a big company, but you have to work very efficiently with lots of tools. And one of the companies we talked about a couple of episodes ago, Michael, was Front App.
Yeah.
And that was really speak. Now, it's interesting because they're a startup and they just got funding, and we talked about their pitch deck and how it got all these accolades. But if you look at what they do, it's actually more interesting than their pitch deck, in my opinion. They allow you to collaborate amongst your team and interact with all the different ways that your customers communicate with you. Facebook, Twitter, email aliases, Slack. And they bring that into a ticketing-like system. I think it's tools such as these that startups can really benefit from, because it speaks to behaving like a larger company or giving the appearance of a larger company. But also, in the example of Front, I think the most important thing is what Adam and previous guests like Brian Baer have said, is that you should be highly customer focused in the beginning, and having some of these tools that allow you to collaborate and channel all your messages so you can have a faster response time speaks to taking care of your customers. And I think that there's a lot of technology that we can benefit from. Now, the kind of sad ending to the story was I didn't quite get on the whole Front train. I tried it and maybe I didn't spend enough time with it, but I'm like, this isn't ready for me to adopt just yet. So
yeah, but let's be fair, feedback. Right? That's the second question, right? Mm-hmm. Is it ready for you? Mm. You know, are you ready? Or are we ready? And the answer could be no, but you looked at it. I like this list. The one I wanted to point out that I thought was interesting was the be busy part, right? So like, to be efficient, invest in your appearance, these things make sense. And I liked how you brought up the bit of, you know, is it trying to be something you're not? You know, it's interesting. I actually try really hard now to be the opposite of busy with people. But what I try to also be is focused. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's that subtle difference. So there's a suggestion here was get a virtual business system and hire a virtual assistant that'll answer it for you and kick it over to you, etc. What I do with people is I just say, listen, I time block and I make it. I've got some time to be available. And if you need a time outside of that, shoot me a note and I will happily schedule it.
I couldn't agree more. I personally have adopted Calendly, and the Security Weekly organization is adopting it, and I think we're going to move into offensive countermeasures. What I'm learning about it is that different strokes for different folks, right? If, for example, the rules I'm developing are, if someone is requesting time with you and they're like a consumer to you, or they're trying to sell you something, or they want to partner with you, like they need something from you essentially, then you can say, yeah, book some time on my calendar and here's the link, right? And yep. I think that works great. There's like these in between use cases where you're not quite sure. You really want them to book the time. You would probably take the time to book them manually, the old fashioned way, as I call it now. So I give them the option. I say, look, I give them some available time slots. I'm available during these times. You want a meeting? Let's meet, you know, I'm available during these times. Or if it's easier for you, you can just book time right on my calendar. And I found it's like a 50-50 success rate, right? And then there's people where, like, you mention Calendly and they kind of just like ignore it or whatever, and you're like, okay, your meeting is important to me enough where I'm gonna book this time however you need me to book it, whether we talk on the phone. Like, if we're on the phone, in fact, I was on the phone with someone yesterday, the day before. He's like, yeah, let's find time on the calendar. I'm like, great, let's just go book it right now, right? You accommodate those people in that way. So you have to understand your audience and how you use some of this technology. My advice, overarching advice, is just don't funnel everyone into your automated technology-based system for customer service. Be smart about your audience.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. I like the fact, too, because I use Calendly as well. And what I like about it is, like, when I teach, for example, the Straight Talk Leadership Experience, everybody gets an individual coaching session with me every week. So I give them a link and I go, look, this is the simplest, best way to be able to schedule that time with me. And they have a very expansive block of time. If you want to pitch me a story idea or an article, cool. I have a much more narrow, and I have rules on it. I can only take one pitch a day. Mm-hmm. And look, I'm on a backlog of writing right now, and I like the pitches. And you know what? People don't mind it because it makes it easier for everybody's schedule. But you're right. There are people that they don't like it. You know what I'm finding, though, too, which is great? 4 or 5 years ago, if you tried to use stuff like this, people are like, what is that? I'm not doing that. Just find a time to talk to me. Now, it's easier to just get on people's calendars, and I think it's gonna continue. But so I like the idea of using these types of things to be better. And then, you know, I just say, too, stay focused, like clear the rest of it out and stay focused on the stuff that's going to make a difference to your customers and to your business. Otherwise, you're wasting your time.
Yep. And we don't have time to waste, right? Especially we've got 5 minutes, like four minutes left in the show, Michael. So go for it, dude. What else you want to cover?
No, you know what? I put some other stuff up over there. If somebody wants to go take a look at it, I threw up an article from Harvard Business about how boards can assess the health of their companies. And I thought, you know, if you're in the startup mode or you're in the security mode, I've got a leadership summit again next week, and we're going to talk about how do you work with the board. I think anytime you get the chance to look at these types of things and say, how are we advising boards to look at companies, you're going to get some insights into what boards are struggling with. If you can be the person that makes it easier for them, I think you're better off. I also put up one on understanding the consumer decision-making process.
I like this one.
Here's the thing. It's the same as the customer decision-making process.
I love it.
And so
the customer decision-making process begins when the customer realizes there is a problem to be solved or a need to be satisfied. You're right. That applies to any kind of selling. Yeah.
And here's the other thing, too, and a lot of people don't remember this. Their first challenge is not just that they realize that they have a problem. It's that they're willing to do something about it. Inertia. Which is, it sucks, and I don't like it, but I'm good with it. No, people will just carry on. You've got to be able to connect with a problem that they have that they're willing to solve. Because if you're going to help them change, change is uncomfortable. And mm-hmm. so it's got to be the status quo has to be worse than their fear over changing and trying something different. Now, I see a lot of people try to play games and make it worse, and I'm going to rub salt in your wound. Don't do that. But connect with people emotionally about what their real challenges are and level with them and show them how you can help them through it. That's why we keep talking about telling people stories and helping them get where they need to be. All right. Well, like in the minute or two we got left, how are you doing? How are things going, Paul?
That's really my focus right now is, shoring up some of our processes, and being number one, focusing on the customer, number two, focusing on our internal processes so we can better serve, the customer. And, the rewrite of the interface is coming along really nicely. And you know, that's pretty much where I'm at right now. Which is, it's a good place to be. We obviously have a lot of work to do, as always, in the startup mode, but that's kind of where I'm at.
That's awesome. That's really good. It turns out a lot of the work I've done over the last couple of weeks has really paid off. And this week, I realized that busy people need a little bit more space. I lengthened out the cohort, added a couple more coaching sessions to it, and I just announced a team package and I got smart finally. It's a beta. So anybody who's in this current cohort, if they come in with 5 people, they get the team package at no extra cost. And that's going to give me the stories and let me figure it out. And then we're going to roll it out and market in January. And it's been a really good way to reward people that act quickly. And I think it has caught some attention. So if you're listening and you're interested, give me a holler. I've still got about a week left, and I can welcome another team or two into it. Otherwise, we'll have some updates in the beginning of the year. We'll see how I did.
And speaking of being customer focused, surveys are great. Don't overdo them. But we did put together our first survey for Security Weekly, securityweekly.com/survey. You can go there. Please fill out our survey. Tell us what you think. And there's an open comments section in the bottom. It's the last question. Keep us entertained. That's all I ask. See if you can entertain us in that last question. But please, your feedback is very valuable, and it helps us shape both the content for the existing shows and what new shows you may want. So if you want to have input as to what you want to listen to on Security Weekly Network, securityweekly.com/survey. And that's it. That concludes this episode of Startup Security Weekly. Thanks, everyone, for listening and watching. We'll see you next week.